trillions will be flowing, pouring into Bitcoin market capitalization pretty soon, latest maybe February 3rd, 4th, starting where Michael Saylor, MicroStrategy, will be open sourcing his playbook. Thousands and thousands of businesses, corporations, boardrooms, small, mid-sized, large, huge ones will be joining. So I'm going to have a talk with Emil Sandstedt, author of Money Dethroned 1 and 2. Check out his Twitter account and buy his book, read his book. It's going to be an amazing talk. We're really looking forward to it. And let me know your questions. Please follow me on Twitter, subscribe to my YouTube channel and my podcast platforms. Thank you so much again for your support. And let me know if you have any wishes, desires for any special guests coming up. Thank you so much, and I'll see you soon. Emil Sandstedt.
All right. Welcome to the show, Emil Sandstedt. Back again on my show. Thank you so much for your time. Emil, how are you?
Thank you very much, Kevin. Thank you for inviting me again. I'm fine.
Yeah. You know, you've been on my show a few times now, but still, you know, there might be always new listeners. Do you want to like give a short recap, like your background as an author? You've written some fascinating books in series like Money Dethroned. Do you want to like give a brief summary about your background, please?
Sure. I've been in Bitcoin some years right now. And the whole thing with writing books, it started actually through, I would say the biggest influence is Saifedean Ammous, because I took his course back in the days and I read his book, of course, The Bitcoin Standard. And it kind of threw me into this path of Austrian economics and how money emerged and how money did not emerge, all this. So it piqued my interest and I started to write articles about this that dealt with a little bit the same as Saifedean talks about, this glass beads and the seashells, etc. You know, that kind of stuff. I published a lot of articles called Tales of Soft Money, detailing how money is actually something that can be destroyed, that can be dethroned. So after a while, I felt like I had so many articles that I could actually compile a book on the subject. Yeah, here you go. There's some different kind of articles that describes how various monies basically are replaced by better monies and that this is a market process. So in any way, I wrote the first book. It's called Money Dethroned, A Historical Journey. Here it is. And it deals with the primitive monies and the metallic monies. So it's kind of the prehistory of money, if you will. So it explains why we could go from hundreds of difference of primitive monies to essentially gold and silver and in a sense copper. So you have this Mengarian effect that you go from many to one. This is, as far as I know, it's only the Austrian school that talks about this effect, because all other schools are basically saying that the state needs to be involved with money. Whereas the Austrian school quickly just states that if you let the market do its thing, money will converge towards one medium, because it's more efficient to have one money than for the world to operate on 200 monies. So it's just cost considerations by individuals that forces all these monies to converge into one. So anyway, this is the dynamic that I explain in this first book, Money Dethroned, A Historical Journey. I try to make it a bit more fun for the reader. So in order not to just write dry recounts of history, it follows in the footsteps of an actual traveler, Ibn Battuta, who traveled all over the world. And he, in his writing, he has observed a lot of these things, the different monies that he used to buy food in Africa, to buy stuff in India and in China, etc. And so to pivot to the second book then, it kind of deals with the same concept, that it follows in the footsteps of a British spy and explorer, Sir Richard Burton. And he is also traveling all these places in the world, and he's not interested in money at all, but he still makes a lot of detailed notes about monies, because he stumbles upon them. He's using glass beads in Africa in the 19th century, for example. He sees the various currency implosions in Brazil, for example, where the paper currency is worth less than the assignat in France. So I draw from his travels also, and I build the same story in the second book, which is called also Money Dethroned, A Journey Through Ashes. And I don't have the physical copy with me now. It's ordered. I guess it will come soon. It is a sequel, but it can be read as a standalone. And in my eyes, it's more relevant than the first one. So I really encourage the readers to check it out. Here it is for anyone who's watching this. It's over 200 pages, and it deals not with the primitive stuff that the first book is dealing with. This is about money failures. So more recent examples, and it's more relevant for us today. So essentially, this is 13 chapters on currencies all over the world, on all continents, in many nations, many different centuries. No matter if it's summer, spring, autumn, or winter, you know, money can implode because it follows monetary laws, it follows economic laws, it doesn't care which country you live in. And it's kind of the point with this book that I prove that with the many money failures of the 18th and 19th centuries, I prove that if you tinker around with inconvertible paper, essentially what we have today in the world, it's very dangerous. So it's in a sense a warning. I don't want to be an alarmist, but it is my warning that I really enjoyed writing also, because it draws from all these separate occasions that all prove that how easy it is to wreck the economy if you wreck the money. And so everyone understands that, for example, hyperinflation wrecks the economy, right? But let's think about a little bit how does the overissuing of money or currency, how does that affect the economy? Well, when people trade with each other in a modern society, I mean, we are not hunter-gatherers. We are not just 30 people who can divide labor. You know, you go and hunt your food, I will go and gather my mushrooms and whatever. That's you could work it out without money if it is that small. But if you want scale, if you have a large society, if you have cities, you need money, because without money you cannot trade. You have the problem of this the coincidence of wants, the problem of direct barter. So money is used to circumvent this problem, as we all know. And that's why when you start to tinker away, or when you overissue the money or the currency, it means that you are hammering away at the very keystone of this bridge. And this bridge is what takes the producers of food, the producers of cars, the producers of shoes and whatever, to the consumers. It's the only way they can communicate on scale. So when you hammer away at the keystone of this bridge, that is money, and the money collapses, that means you can imagine if the bridge collapses, there's no way to get over the river then. And that's really, really dangerous. I prove it in my book, what happens when you wreck the money. Trade cannot operate. That means that for millions of people living in the cities, how can they start to grow food quickly? It's not possible. They need to have money. So yeah, so in order not to rant too long, well, the second book is a warning, how easy it is to wreck paper currencies. Inconvertible paper currencies, I might add. And this is the system that we have today. So when the Federal Reserve and the central banks are now expanding their balance sheets, that's their way of hammering away at the keystone that I talk about. They increase, they leverage the risk on the whole monetary system, the more these balance sheets are increased, the more systemic risk you will have of, you know, money failures in the future. So I thought it was a timely, 2020 was a timely period for me to write this book, and I got it out just before the new year. Let's hope the warning doesn't come to fruition, but it seems like these guys, they don't really know what they're doing. So they're continuing to expanding the balance sheets right now. They continue to increase the money supply in the system, and they think that it's good, but it can't be good.
Emil, let us discuss a little bit in light of the current events that are ongoing with the, you know, with the whole manipulation of the, what do you call it, the stock market, with Robin Hood and the shorts, naked short selling. Do you want to give my listeners some kind of background story and tie it in with this broken money we have, this you know, fiat money that where people are actually forced to, you know, to go into these kind of, you know, waste a lot of time and energy going into the stock market and trying to, you know, speculate on things. And then you have, you know, this totally two-tiered system. You know, you have the legacy system and you have the retail traders. The retail traders have no chance against the legacy system because it's all rigged, right? Would it be, you know, the rehypothecation of assets, of securities? What's your opinion on that? How can you tie this into the money?
Well, I have followed what has happened with GameStop a little bit, not in depth because it takes too much time. It's very entertaining, and I think it's despicable that they were not allowed to sell their shares that they bought, because when you buy a share at Robinhood, for example, I mean, it's in the contract that you must be able to sell it later, right? So I think this violated contract law, basically. It's not the free market doing its thing. You know, when Twitter kicks off some persons, I don't really care, because it's not like your property rights were violated, in my opinion. But when you cannot sell the property that you bought on this platform, that's a different story. And a lot of people lose a lot of money. So this is a mess. I hope that they bring litigation and, you know, go after these guys, because it's such a blatant conflict of interest. The owners of Robinhood are owned themselves by some of these players that lost a lot of money when the shares went up, or that would have lost a lot of money. So that's very bad. And to connect it to the money, you say, well, this is one connection is this is all centralized. They could stop the trading because they felt like they had to. And centralized custodians in this manner, they are security holds. I mean, you can lose a lot by trusting them too much, which many people have done now. I don't know any way around it. People talk about DeFi, etc., but you know, that has its own problems. You can have your DeFi contracts explode because of some bugs, and you lose a lot more. So there's, I don't know any way around it. But the problem is centralization, and that the state has so much power that, you know, I don't know what happened in this case with the GameStop, but if the state or any of its underdogs were somehow involved, the SEC, for example, to cut the losses for these hedge funds because they didn't want the hedge funds to blow up and cause ripple effects. No, that's bad. It impedes on the free market again when the SEC and the state interferes. So to summarize, I'm on the side of the redditors in this case.
Yeah, I think. I mean, the way I would explain is that it started off with, was it Melvin Capital or Melvin Institution that sort of tried to short the GameStop stocks, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So they sold more shares than there were outstanding existing. And then there mm-hmm. were, you know, a bunch of, what I don't know what they call them themselves, Wall Street bettors or something like that on Reddit that... one of these guys on Reddit, he had found out a long time ago that he found out, he researched which stocks were most shorted. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like one of those was GameStop. So what they did is like they got together and bought like more and more of the stocks. And while the other institution, the Legacy Foundation, which I think it was the same entity, the same characters that were actually in 2008 were bailed out, right? With billions, and actually, you know, in totality with all the institutions in trillions. And I'm just trying to, you know, give a recap maybe to our listeners. Like, this is the consequence, I think. This is these are the second, third order effects when you have a broken money. I think this is the message I'm trying to convey. Is that correct?
I think you are correct in a sense, because if the money is easily produced, it's much, much more easy to embark on these bailouts. Let's go back to 2008. If the state, or if rather the financial system, those entrenched in the financial system, wanted more money or more liquidity for various reasons, they could get it through the central bank or through orders from above, essentially. And this is something, it's very bad, because it introduces all of this this moral hazard that, okay, yeah, they bailed us out, let's take more risk next time, because we are we might be even bigger, or we are probably already bigger than 2009. Everything has grown. There is more debt out there right now. So you just build moral hazard on moral hazard. And people think very short term, politicians think short term, because they want to be reelected. So the only solution is to have a money that the state can't mass produce. I'm against the tax also, but then they have to actually gather taxes first, and they have to use this sparse resources to really choose, okay, this company is very important for us, let's bail it out, and let's let these other 9 fail. Now they can bail out all the 10, just take on more debt, because the currency is issued against debt. You can just increase the asset and the liability side of the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. So it's all short-term thinking. It's, it's a very fragile system. Mm-hmm. It looks to me.
Let me read, because Marty Bent sends out a newsletter every day, but this one was a short one. He says, it starts off, it's pretty funny. It says, George Carlin, the comedian who died, I think, many years ago, is super funny. The guy, George Carlin, was so goddamn prescient. After today, if it isn't abundantly clear to you that we live in a two-tiered society I described yesterday, there may be no hope for you. The abrupt halting of the ability of retail investors to buy GME, AMC, NOK on Robinhood and a few other trading platforms was nothing short of criminal. The only option users had on Robinhood was to hold or sell. There were even reports of Robinhood forced selling on behalf of users for their own safety, making it so the price could only go in one direction, down. In favor of Melvin Capital, Citadel, by the way, Citadel did a lot of millions of contribution to the Biden administration, we just found out. In favor of Melvin Capital, Citadel, and others who were caught with their pants down. Again, this was criminal, and everyone involved should be tried for manipulation. These actions are also leading me to believe that my hunch that the 10-day army was pulling forward a systemic collapse is a good hunch. Today is a pivotal day for a modern civilization. I won't be surprised if this is pinpointed as an inflection point that leads to mass exodus away from the kleptocratic elite. The energy flowing through social media today was palpable. The people are absolutely pissed and seem primed to do something about it. So, I'm just saying, the reason I'm reading this is that I think thanks, to the internet and to the social media, with all the censorship still going on, even on Twitter and whatever. And I mean, there were just 100,000 negative comments removed by Apple and Google from Robinhood because they were downgraded to like one or something. Right. It's unbelievable. Right. And these are just, second, third, and maybe even fourth order effects and consequences, which you can see. But because of this, chain reaction of communication and people finally waking up and, interconnecting with one another and understanding more and more the bigger picture, also thanks to you, so this is why I want to go a little bit into this rabbit hole. Like, what, these are just symptoms we're witnessing, but it always goes to the root, and that is money, because it's not, finally we have Bitcoin, now maybe you want to talk about Bitcoin. What can we do with Bitcoin? Can we, finally make the controlling structures, which have been, in control of the issuance of money, of the manipulation of money, of the inflation and hyperinflation, of the debasement of money, responsible, obsolete?
Well, I will tell you what I think about how Bitcoin affects the current system. And it does affect it in a positive way, because states have monopoly in money, kind of a monopoly. It's still legal in most countries to own Bitcoin, etc. They haven't caught up with it yet, or they have decided not to to ban it. But Bitcoin keeps their bad fiat currencies in check, because they can't really play around with, for example, the dollar too much, because everyone is in a free market, in the American market. People can view the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, and they can assess the credit risk. This credit risk on the balance sheet, it's tied to the value of the dollar. So if they play around too much and they buy too many junk bonds, I mean, the credit risk gets just too high, and people will not want to hold these dollars. They try to get rid of them for other assets, and that's what causes inflation. The price of the dollar declines. That's the same as prices of everything else goes up. So if there is this alternative that is hard to stop, which Bitcoin is, that means that the money managers that don't know anything about economics, they need to at least try to keep a semblance of integrity of their fiat currencies, or they will see an escape from it. You can't have a mass exodus right now, because Bitcoin is simply not ready for it. This might change in the future if it can scale in a decentralized way through the Lightning Network. We have talked a little bit about this. So it's just a gradual process. And for every day that passes, these more and more people can actually join the Bitcoin network. So Bitcoin is already now affecting what they are doing with the money. But that doesn't mean that they are smart enough to realize that they have to actually care about the quality of the currency. They might... it might implode anyway, and then we are in deep trouble, because Bitcoin can't, you know, yet. So I hope that they you know, take it easy, but it doesn't look like they're doing it. They are doing this quantitative easing. It's kind of an Orwellian term, because it doesn't make it easier for anyone. If you issue more currency, it just leads to more hardships down the line. You push the problem forward. So nothing gets easier when they issue any new currency. A fixed quantity currency is the best currency. That's just how it works. Anything else is a fallacy. It's a fallacy that 97% of the world actually believes. So yeah, that's one way to tie how Bitcoin is operating right now to what is happening with the financial system. So did you have anything else in mind?
Okay, let's suppose you know, it will, this development with the Lightning and the transition to a, you know, to a hard money will become facilitated much easier, you know, on every level, you know, not only as a store of value, but as a settlement layer, a medium of exchange, you know, with all the development going on, Lightning, Jack Mueller's what do you call it, Strike, and every other, you know, infrastructure that can be built within and surrounding Bitcoin. Let's just say it really, you know, will be accomplished within the next few years. How do you see then, you know, the second, third order effects ongoing? What can be achieved? What's the benefit to society, to the individual out there, to the sovereignty?
Yeah, that would be a great benefit. There are a number of things that if they implode their own currencies, which some nations will do, and they have already done it in Venezuela and other nations, people often forget these small nations because they're unimportant, their industries are destroyed, they are, you know, someone else's problem. People think that these things cannot happen to themselves, but it can. We are not different from Venezuelans, we're humans, and it can affect your country also, and it has affected all of our developed nations in Europe, in the US. US has had hyperinflation. Europe has had so many instances of hyperinflation. I think that if the scaling continues on its road, and also we scale through certain central, this is a bit controversial maybe, but if we scale also through certain centralized custodians, We know what happened with gold, that it got co-opted. So we can't put too much in the centralized solutions. Then we will be screwed. But if you put, you know, pocket money in it, essentially, the things that you want to use for very, very low transaction fees, that helps to scale Bitcoin in a way. And then we keep, you know, the large, or we, I shouldn't speak for others, but if I would keep my own Bitcoin, I would keep the majority on a decentralized solution, of course. That would mean, I mean, more wealth for everyone. That would facilitate better, better financial organization. As I said, if they mess with the money, that leads to some really bad things, and all the different contracts in the economy are thrown into disorder. Creditors are ruined. Debtors, you know, they can celebrate. You have all these externalities that are really, really bad. It becomes unprofitable to invest in factories, etc., because you do not know what purchasing power you will your customers will have in the future. So whatever Bitcoin can do to facilitate, you know, hard money behind the white legal system, that's good for everyone. It might be bad for the state, but it's good for us as individuals who want to trade our labor with each other, that we have something to choose from.
Now, you've probably heard and you know, seen that the Michael sale of MicroStrategy is going to start on February 3rd and 4th, open sourcing his playbook. And allegedly, there are thousands of businesses, corporate boardrooms, even Walt Disney, I heard, you know, we don't know the full list, but it seems that starting February 3rd, it's actually my birthday. he's gonna open source his playbook. So, do you see like a huge flow pouring of, you know, billions or maybe even trillions of institutional money into Bitcoin, into as a reserve asset?
Well, probably, and you know, that's how I use Bitcoin. Also, I use it as a reserve asset that's easy to move between borders, etc. So then, it's not really money yet. Money, that's what I buy. Use when I buy food, electricity, etc., you know, everyday purchases. So Bitcoin can be used not only as money, but it can be used as this this thing that can't be taken from you. Gold historically was both money and the reserve asset. Bitcoin right now is a budding reserve asset, I would say, and it works very well for it. So yeah, these companies, I haven't thought much about it, but I guess it's in their interest also, not, of course, not to own a lot of government bonds, and if they need something, you know, I don't know. It's tricky because if they have also, if they make profit and the pile of wealth in the companies grow, it's always an option to do a dividend and let the individual owners of the company do what they want with the money, right? Some might want to buy Bitcoin. So it's a bit tricky. Some owners of the share might not want the board to speculate on various assets, but it's up to the company. I mean, it's their resources, so they can do what they want with it. I for sure think that more companies will continue to buy Bitcoins. We have seen what's going on right now. It's obvious. Yeah. It's going to continue.
And it's showing, you know, especially if you look at the EU, it's, I think there's a catastrophe coming. And there's, you know, other experts like, you know, Markus Pollack. No, I'm sorry, what's his name? Dr. Markus Kral, Dr. Thorsten Pollack. Mm-hmm. They're both Austrian economists and very, I mean, they're gold bugs more or less, but their analysis is very, you know, very sharp. You know, in Germany alone, there are approximately 800,000 zombified companies. So they're going to infect other healthy companies. It's especially, you know, it's in light of all the lockdown and the whole political things that's going on in the background. So, and then you have the central bank, the ECB, you know, similar to the Fed or any other central bank, printing or, you know, creating money out of thin air. So the debt spiral will get worse and worse. And I think people are finally waking up. The reason I'm asking you is because once institutions coming in, I think
the connection is a little bit bad now, Kevin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, can you hear me now? Is it better? Can you hear me? Is it better now?
Yeah, I hear you now, I think I can hear you now. Do you hear me?
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, I have to edit it. Okay.
Okay. Now let's continue with what you were talking about, these zombie companies, because I think this is very important. That's what happens when you artificially lowers the interest rate, because the interest rate, it represents the cost of capital that you borrow to expand your business. You hire workers, you hire, you rent all these machines, you build a factory, etc. So when you manipulate the interest rate and you lower the interest rate, all the companies in the economy, healthy companies in a free market economy, they think that suddenly there is an abundance of capital. So they embark on all these expansionary projects. And of course, there isn't an abundance of capital. There is not magically more machines out there on the street just because they lowered interest rate. So what they find out in the middle of the expansion, when it half the new hotel or half the new factory, they realize that the costs are increasing. We need to pay more because we cannot all compete for the same labor. We cannot all compete for the same machines. So a low interest rate hides the fact that there is just a finite number of machines and workers and you know, everything. So it distorts the price of capital, of real things in the economy. So what happens is that some of these companies that embarked on expansion, they need to abandon the products because there simply is not, you cannot import aliens to work for you. There is only a fixed number of people that can work for you, for example. So they abandon them. And that's why you see in certain, I think Spain is a good example. I might have mentioned this for you earlier, but when they joined the euro, the interest rate fell there and you had this building boom that everyone wanted to start to build hotels and you know, real estate. So when you took the car around Spain for 10 years ago, you could see all of these projects that were just ghost towns. They started.
There still are, right? I mean, there still are. I mean,
I think so. I haven't taken the car there, but when I was there like 10 years ago, it was like this. You could see them, and that's an example of capital destruction, because you have all these machines have built these things, and you have people who have worked on these projects, and they have to abandon them in the middle of everything. That's destroying capital. that's why zombie companies. Are just a proxy for, it shows how much capital is destroyed all the time. And what happens when you destroy capital? Well, capital is what separates, I like this expression, it's what separates the age of the cave from the age of the skyscraper. We are in the age of the skyscraper. There's only one thing that separates today from how people lived 20,000 years ago. They had no capital. We have accumulated capital for thousands and thousands of years. These are the machines and factories and everything. So you don't want this accumulated stock of capital to start deteriorate. So, but that's what happened. That's what they're doing. The capital is deteriorating. I mean, it's always deteriorating, even in a market economy, but it's repaired and grow. So in a market economy, the total stock of capital always increases because that's how people like to make a profit. When you just distort the interest rate, the price of capital, you end up in some periods, you destroy more of it than what is built. So it's a net destruction of capital. That's probably what's going on right now when you have all these zombie companies, because people are working on these zombie companies. They're wasting capital. They're working there. They have probably factories, some of these zombie companies. They have machines, etc. They are utilizing capital that is not profitable, but the central planners have made it profitable because they pushed the interest rate so low. So I hope the listeners understand this dynamic.
Yeah. And you know what the real problem is? I mean, especially in Germany, is that with all these zombified companies, as I've listened, you know, to some other German-speaking experts, they're saying that they're actually being instigated or you know, they're being told not to go into insolvency, even though they are insolvent. So this is actually criminal, because if you're insolvent, you need to go into insolvency, right?
Yeah, these people that work on these companies, they can work on the thriving companies instead. But they are, since the state kind of puts them in these zombie companies. They're stuck there, and there's a lack of resources then, a lack of people to work on actually good companies. This is how you destroy capital.
You know, as Safed Namous calls Bitcoin the number go up technology. I know it's a slightly different point now, but just wanted to go back to Bitcoin again, is that the reason I ask about the institutional money pouring in into Bitcoin, and that's going to be, I think, a sort of a slowly but suddenly, a gradual and suddenly, you know, according to Parker Lewis terminus thing. Do you think it will cause a chain reaction in the, you know, mass adoption, like retailers, like individuals? Because, you know, once the number goes up and the market capitalization of Bitcoin goes to easily, you know, 1 trillion, 2 trillion, do you think then it will be, I mean, it's already mainstream. Bitcoin is already mainstream. But do you think that it will somehow, steer up something like a chain reaction?
I don't know about chain reaction, because that implies that it's very easy to onboard. And I know that this is a bit unpopular, but it is hard to deal with Bitcoin as a retailer now, for example, if you're not tech savvy and you have your channels, Lightning channels, for example, it's hard, because if it were easy, it would already be widespread. You would have people out in the economy accepting BTC because they realize that it's something that is not diluted, and there's low costs on using it as a medium of exchange. But there is yet not much of this. When the Lightning implementations get better and better, you will see more and more adoption. But I think to realize that this is hard, Bitcoin is more than 10 years old, and the protocol hasn't changed massively during this time. And yet, after all these years, we are still struggling with the scaling in a decentralized manner. So it's a very tough work, and it's hard. And of course, I think some people will absolutely be successful in implementing it profitably. But right now, it's difficult, or we would have seen the market embrace it more quickly. So I see kind of a slow expansion ahead for Bitcoin as a reserve asset, and then more and more slowly as a way to use this money.
Yeah, but that's what I meant. I mean, that more and more people just, decide to accumulate Bitcoin as a store of value, just, as a saving technology.
I think this will continue, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So I think there will be critical mass by, in the next few years. And, but it could be, it could happen much faster because of the institutional money, pouring in. And now it's becoming sort of socially acceptable for Bitcoin,
Definitely. It's a different feeling right now after it recovered from the 2017 crash there, and just blew the old all-time high. I mean, it's done it so many times now, and people start to actually understand a little bit more. They don't accept the theories that they have been told, these shallow theories of why Bitcoin can't work. More and more people are realizing that it's just lies. Everyone's saying that Bitcoin can't work, and yet it's working all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, nothing changed.
So I think we will have a continual, adoption in this matter as a reserve asset. There's more and more currency or money entering the system, and that's also flowing towards Bitcoin. And I think one good example would be the negative yield on bonds, because mm-hmm. people pay to have their they pay to park their money somewhere, and not even good money. If you're a creditor in this world, you can get screwed over even without negative interest rates. So a lot of this has to do with regulations, that some, the pension funds, etc., they have to have these bonds. And if you have to have something, you push up the price. And when the bond price goes up, that's the same as the yield going down. But still, as long as there is such a low interest rates, it's much better economically to just shift to Bitcoin. So I think it's one good indicator. As long as you have all these low interest rates, Bitcoin can just continue to grow. When you don't have it anymore, when you actually get yield on your lending, then people will start to think more about, but I can lend my money instead of putting it into Bitcoin and actually get a real yield. So, but we don't have this yield now. It's negative.
Yeah. And I think it was Preston Pish who started off with the $100 trillion bond market, you know, being like being on the risk that it could implode. We have $100 trillion bond market. Do you think a lot of that money will pour into Bitcoin once, you know, once the cat is out of the bag?
I don't know, but this is this giant pile of bad bonds, it's very dangerous because these bonds, they are on the asset side of the central banks. And what does this mean? That means that when currency is issued, the currency goes out into the financial system, and the Federal Reserve, for example, acquires a bond for as a payment. So assets and liabilities increases equally. So on the asset side, they have a lot of bonds. And the reason this is important is when the dollar enters the economic system, the financial system, it has to have a way back to the Federal Reserve to be burned again. Otherwise, you have inflation, runaway inflation. And this is the system today, that it has a way back through the bonds. The money is entering the system through debt, and the debt is repaid, and the money comes back, and everyone is happy, you know. And the state has done a little sinuous profit in the equation. But then, in any case, when you have large-scale implosions of bond markets, that's that they are defaulting on the bonds. That means that there is no way for the money to get back. Then you have hyperinflation, and that's extremely dangerous. So I really hope it doesn't happen. I would much prefer a controlled collapse of their over-borrowing and over-consumption. But, you know, politicians, they like to promise a lot of things for the voters. It's easier to spend money that you don't have if it's not if it doesn't have much repercussions on you. It's kind of a bug in the democratic system that you get votes if you promise people stuff that you have not, you know, obtained. If you can just issue money. So we'll see what happens. I really hope for a good solution in all this, because yeah, I will not scare the listeners more. It can be very bad.
So Bitcoin is transition.
it's transition, and I still think we will see this continual siphoning from these other kind of overvalued assets to Bitcoin. And I actually think we'll see continual siphoning to gold also, gold and Bitcoin. Because people do not want to put everything, they have different risk characteristics. Bitcoin has some better things than gold, and gold has some things that Bitcoin doesn't have. But people don't want to put everything. I mean, who wants to own bonds right now? It's insane. Right.
Well, the thing
bonds
is,
are at all time high.
Yeah, it depends on the degree of comprehension. I think once you understand Bitcoin, and there's people, you know, there are more and more people saying that, you know, what do I need gold for? Because once you can somehow, you know, break up the manipulation of the gold price, and there's a strengthening in demand, you can, if you want to, you know, create more gold if you want. I mean, just depending on the time, resources, energy, and the technological innovation you put into gold. And this is something, yeah. Right?
I mean, paper gold cannot protect people against what may happen. You know, when you have this implosion of debt, for example, there's not a chance in hell that the states will let paper gold be. They will try to obtain wealth from there through either taxation or direct confiscations of various kinds. So it's about having an asset that can't be confiscated. And that's where Bitcoin excels. It's really hard to confiscate. So paper gold is not an answer to what's going on today in the world. It would be physical gold.
Physical
I don't gold. Have any physical, but yeah. For those who, I understand if people were going for the physical, but to go to the paper gold and think that you're safe from the looters, that's not how it works.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, they're just, it's just over-leveraged, paper gold versus physical gold. But I really meant, you know, the discovery, or what do you call it, the mining of physical gold. I think that can be, if the necessary time, energy, and technological innovation and resources are put into the mining of gold, into the discovery of gold, they can find more physical gold. And that's I think the tricky part about gold, which we haven't seen yet. I think it's possible, and versus, you know, the because always, you know, always about the relative scarcity of gold versus of the absolute scarcity of Bitcoin. And I think the absolute scarcity is just, you know, is always by order of magnitude more valuable in the long term.
I think it's hard to find more gold, but I mean, there's not a zero probability of it can happen that that we can find gold easier. Right now, it has been added production under 2% per year for, I think, 50 years. But of course, that can change. With Bitcoin, it is rather about software bugs, which luckily enough for Bitcoin, they're hard to find out about because we can verify the supply. So we have had supply issues. We have had supply bugs in Bitcoin before where, you know, they're created from thin air and then it's patched very quickly. So these kind of things can happen to Bitcoin. But I think the total risk of having the supply increase in Bitcoin more than gold is much, much lower, as you say, because we don't know what kind of bugs are out there and how easy it is to spot everything. With these privacy protocols like Zcash and Monero, there it's much harder to notice when someone has found a bug and they start to create coins from thin air.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
I think bugs have already been fixed, don't you think so, in Bitcoin? I mean, maybe it was in the beginning they could have somehow, you know, destroyed Bitcoin in the beginning. But now, after 12 years, it's already set in stone. I mean, it's the fundamental property, I mean, of Bitcoin, the absolute scarcity with whatever the last Bitcoin to be mined in 2140 and with all the other monetary and technological properties, it's set in stone. So, and then you've got, you know, the stock to flow ratio that's going to take over gold. And right now it's what, between 55 and 60 with gold, and Bitcoin will exceed the stock to flow ratio, I think, by next half.
Up to 100 or something. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's correct. No, I'm not worried at all about dilution in supply for Bitcoin. I run my own full node, so no one can force me to change the code. And my code is 21 million. That's right. What I'm going to run. It's in my self-interest to not inflate the supply. So gold has a bigger problem in this regard.
Yeah. And we really don't know how much gold there is. I mean, there's always these statistics of 200,000 tons or 190,000 tons of gold existing stock, and the flow of gold yearly between 2% or 1.8, 2%, 2.5%. But we really don't even know like how much gold there is deposited at the central banks, how much gold there is really. I mean, this is the intransparency versus the full transparency of Bitcoin that's always going to shine out, right? Or shine through. Mm. Okay, Emil, any other perspectives you have before we wrap up?
Well, since we're wrapping up, I can tell the readers that get my book on Amazon. It's an ebook, so Kindle or paperback. It's 200 pages. It's a very interesting read, in my opinion, because it draws a lot from eyewitness accounts on these money failures. And you will see that for hundreds of years ago, the people living back then, they observed the same things, that the same idiotic notions that you will observe today. When the politicians promised that the issues will not be a problem in the future, that they need to do it to have to get the economy going again, etc., etc. It's the same stuff, and they really they imploded their economies with tyranny and authoritarianism as a result. So get it. It's not just to scare people. It's very interesting from a historical perspective to read these guys, what they were thinking back then.
Yeah, and I also that you package it in a, you know, as a story, because I think you can reach much more, many more people by you know, formulating it through a storyteller, through a story on or whatever you call it, you know, like a novel or something. So I think people, instead of, you know, very dry historical facts, mm-hmm. But I think it can open up the minds and the hearts of people much, you know, in a much more easy way.
Yeah, I agree. And if I could, you know, pick one observation from the book that kind of that I want to you to that I want to stick with you. It's that after the Continentals in the US imploded, you know, they had the revolution in 1776. There were important writers there that compared the implosion of the Continentals to what massacres the English had conducted on the continent. And they came to the conclusion that more people had perished from the money implosion than from the artillery and muskets from the enemy. So these are really serious matters. You better not screw around with the money too much. That's what I hope more and more people realize, that it's not a toy.
Yeah, and I hope this is the inflection point of 2021, where we really learn out of history, because it seems like people haven't really, you know, we as human civilization, as society, haven't really learned from history a lot. So things are repeating, indoctrination going on and conditioning. So, but there maybe, I don't know, maybe the pain point is now different. I really don't know, but. So yeah, any other places people can follow you?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Besant Denier, or just search for Emil Sandstedt. I have a Medium page also, so you can find me there. Search for Emil Sandstedt, and also my webpage bdratings.org has all my old articles for free, and there's a lot of sources there also to free books that are uploaded on archive.org, that so you can read all these historical accounts for free if that's your thing.
Okay, Emil, thank you so much for your time and for your contribution. People really are hungry for knowledge for the first time when it comes to money now, and I think we're getting it. I think we're finally, you know, at the root of all the symptoms now. And we're finally getting it. Maybe it's because also of the interconnectedness. So thank you so much for your contributions and your educational work in the background.
Thank you, Kevin. And I would love to be back on your show anytime.
Let's do a panel discussion in the very near future. Okay, Emil, take care and have a good day.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Hey, hope you love this talk with Emil Sandstedt as much as I did. Really was amazed at his depth of his knowledge. So, you know, it's going all to the root cause, to the core of all the symptoms and all the second order, third, whatever effects. So, you know, mass adoption is coming sooner or later. It's the trillions are pouring into Bitcoin, and, you know, Bitcoin fixes this. And that's why we have all these, you know, manipulation, fraud, criminality going on by order of magnitude. So let me know what you think. Let me know your questions. Please follow me and Emil Sandstedt on Twitter. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel and podcast platform. Leave a 5-star review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. That helps a lot the algorithm so that the educational materials is distributed more and more. And let me know your questions if you have any. And hope you loved it. And I'll see you soon again. Bye.